Hey guys, I don't know if you're like me, but I love Count the Dings and everything it has to offer. I just can't find everything I need. You know, I know about Cinephobe, and I know about the mailbag, and I know about Bomb, but that's all we do, right, Amin?
No, we do so much more.
What?
Yeah, absolutely. If you sign up, patreon.com/countthedings, you'll find a plethora of other content, fresh content, extended content, the OG Pod Overflow, the Cinephobe Cold Opens that we've taken and made their own thing to live only there, the Rewatchingtons, Bomb in its full and unadulterated cut, early drops of Cinephobe episodes, and so much more.
You said the OG Pod. Now, is it new or is it old?
Mace, I'm glad you asked that. It is a new incarnation of the old OG Pod.
Oh.
So it's me, Zach, Trey, Waz, Tom.
I love those guys.
Just like we always were, going back to the True Hoop days, we're recreating that magic, recapturing it, and putting it back out. We're talking hoops, we're talking pop culture, and most importantly, we're talking for 40 minutes for free, but then another specific Patreon exclusive segment for every one of those episodes.
Funny enough about that OG Pod, you're getting Tom and Trey on Mondays, you're getting me and Waz, aka Zosny, on Wednesdays. Amin's floating in between.
I'm a floater.
You never know when you're going to get Amin in those, so you got to listen to them all.
And what if I'm not sure what Maze looks like, because I've always thought he's a fat man with a fedora, he's got a weird voice. How can I see for myself what this Maze character actually looks like?
It's crazy you don't know the answer to this because it's the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page.
What?
The CT5s on the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page. You can look at all of us.
You can get all the OG pods on YouTube too, at Count the Dings 1 on YouTube, at Cinephobe Pod on YouTube. Patreon.com/countthedings gets you everything all in one feed. You can link it to your Spotify. And now enjoy the show.
Hey, listener, Zach Harper here. Underdog Fantasy, the easiest place to play fantasy sports. Also, fastest growing fantasy app in the industry. Here's how it works. The Pick'em game. Pick whether your favorite players will have a higher or lower stat total in this week's game for a chance to win big. How big, you ask? I'm so glad you asked that question, listener. You can win up to 100 times your money in a single night. Pick between 2 and 5 players, build a pick'em entry. You can also do rivals picks. You can put like Tyrese Haliburton and Jalen Brunson against each other, and whoever has more points, more assists, more rebounds, whatever you want to do, that is your rivals pick. I would maybe go with Jalen Brunson in these playoffs. By the way, in the regular season, Jalen Brunson, scoring tear, going higher on his point totals all the time. Joel Embiid, whenever he did actually play, higher on his scoring totals all the time. Victor Wembanyama, for the next 15, 20 years, here's a pro tip for you, take higher on the blocks. That's right. So you're probably wondering, how do you sign up? Oh my God, listener, you are full of good questions today. Sign up with the promo code DING, that's D-I-N-G, to claim your special pick first-time deposit offer, up to $250 in bonus cash. $250, man, that's a lot. Visit underdogfantasy.com or find them in the App Store. And don't forget to register with our code DING, D-I-N-G, to claim your special pick and first-time deposit offer, up to $250 in bonus cash. Must be 18 or older, 21 or older in Massachusetts, Arizona, 19 or older in Alabama and Nebraska, and present in a state where Underdog Fantasy operates. Terms apply. Concerned with your play, call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit www.ncpgambling.org. Arizona 1-800-NEXT-STEP, that's 1-800-639-8783, or text NEXT STEP to 53342. New York, call the 24/7 HOPE line at 1-877-8-HOPE-NY, or text HOPE-NY 467-369.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the latest edition of The Woke Bros. Of course, I'm your host, Big Waz, a.k.a. Waz D. Lambray, joined as always by my comrade, still looking pretty tan, not just because he's a Spaniard, but because he's been on a perma vacay.
Yeah.
For how long now? Nando Vila, what's up, brother?
What's up, Waz? How's it going?
I'm good, man. I'm good. On today's show, Lionel Messi has been forced, strong-armed into staying with Barcelona. We're going to wrap that story up, tell you guys what to watch, tell you guys how you should be thinking about things this January when these conversations are going to rear their ugly heads again. So we're just going to kind of tie a bow on something that we touched on last week. Joe Biden is getting pressure from the black bourgeoisie to basically not adhere to purity tests, quote unquote, from the left about appointments and cabinet positions within a potential Biden administration, not coming from the Wall Street and financial sector. We're going to get into the ridiculousness of that. But first, because we have to, and we typically don't do, President Trump is a big idiot, doofus, maniac, dangerous loon stuff on this show, because there's enough of that out there. And I don't think anybody who's listening to us has any illusions about who our president is and what he's about. But, you know, we're taping this on a Wednesday afternoon here. And, you know, Bob Woodward's book is coming out. It's about President Trump's response to the coronavirus. And essentially, he's got President Trump on tape saying, the coronavirus is bad, it's dangerous, it's deadly, but I'm not going to go public with the information because I don't want people to panic. It looks bad on me. I'm not doing it. He essentially tells Bob Woodward on a phone call, like, I'm straight up not going to freaking tell the American people the truth because it makes me look bad and I love my precious economy. It's what I plan on running on. So I'm just going to sort of play out the string and lie to the people.
This is more deadly. This is 5% versus 1% and less than 1%. You know, so this is deadly stuff.
We show cases, 99% of which are totally harmless.
Not just older.
Yeah, exactly.
People, to plenty of young people.
Young people are almost immune to this disease.
It's also more deadly than your strenuous flus.
We lose thousands and thousands of people a year to the flu. We don't turn the country off.
I wanted to always play it down. I still like playing it down.
Of course, there's ethical problems with Bob Woodward's handling of this information as a journalist. He probably should have got this information out to the public as soon as possible. Instead, he sat on it so that he could sell a book about it. Bob Woodward, yes, we get it. Him and Bernstein broke Watergate. They're journalist legends and all of that stuff. But in the intervening years, man, Bob Woodward has essentially become a corporate hack. there's just no two ways about it. But this is big news. This is the president on tape saying what we all essentially knew, that he was lying to his followers and the public about the dangers of the virus, what he actually knew to be true of the virus. And he came out and sold the American people a bill of goods. As a result, millions of people got sick. Hundreds of thousands have died as a result of the virus. It's a disaster. This is the type of news that would sink in any normal time. It would sink any leader of any serious nation. It would just completely be a disaster for their campaign. I don't know that this will matter in any meaningful way as far as the election is concerned. I don't know if the Biden campaign and that team over there is smart enough to exploit this and use this for their benefit electorally. We don't know that. We just know this is big. This is a big deal, and it's horrible.
Yeah. No, like you said, Waz, in any serious society, this would,
it'd be finished.
Make the president resign, in a parliamentary system, this would probably cause the fall of the government, and they would have to hold new elections for something like this, something so egregious, you know, where the president was blatantly lying to the American people, is not only like caught lying, but caught on tape. You know, like, it's kind of like the Ray Rice thing, you know, like, it's different when the domestic abuse is like, you read about it in the newspaper or something, but when there's a video of it, like, our just the reaction from the public is so much worse. And, you know, in this case, Trump can't even do like the, well, it's just he said, she said, you know, like, it just reported out of context or whatever. And like, no, like, this is like the full tape again. But, you know, the everything about this is kind of infuriating, because obviously the president lied to the American people, which probably caused people to not take the virus as, or at least a significant chunk of the American public not to take the virus seriously early on. I mean, this was done. Woodward did this interview on February 7th. You know, this was before kind of shit got real with the coronavirus. So, yeah, it probably would have saved lives had the president said what he said to Woodward in public. It would have saved thousands of lives, probably. That being said, also, Woodward probably should have released this when he had the goods. Like, if he had a tape of the president saying, and he's been holding this for 6 months, you know, like, just to be able to sell more book copies, that's borderline. I mean, it's certainly unethical to me from a journalistic standpoint, but borderline kind of criminal, even in that, you know, Woodward could have changed the narrative dramatically around the coronavirus in those early months, right? Had, you know, having a tape of the president saying these things, like, it's a really deadly thing. It flies through the air, you know, like, it maybe would have saved, even if it would have saved a few hundred lives, like, it's worth it. Like, think about that, you know? So, yeah, I mean, but like you said, would it have meaningfully changed anything? I mean, that in that sense, it's like that's like a very like kind of you're blackpilled at that point, you know, like, then why do anything? Like, why, if nothing's going to change the narrative on anything, then it's just like the only upshot is to just like pack up and go home and just sit in your corner and not like we wouldn't even be doing this show. We wouldn't, you know what I mean? Like, you know, at some point you have to believe that these things actually could have an effect. And, you know, just the presence of the tape. I mean, I know he got away with the pussy tape, grabbing by the pussy tape and all that stuff, but like, this is different in nature, you know, like, the grabbing by the pussy tape at the end of the day is not like a policy.
Right.
You know what I mean? Whereas this, like, this is clearly like a policy that would affect the lives of hundreds of thousands of people.
And as with so many things that come out involving President Trump, part of me is like, is there anybody who actually thought this wasn't the case?
Yeah.
That he knew exactly what the threat was?
Trump is a huge germaphobe. Like, there's no way, like, the first time you heard about, like, you know, like, they're talking about, like, you know, the threats and the thing, and like, they, you know, they can't get him to pay attention, you know, they have to, like, you know, sit him down for the security briefings, and it's like, oh, you know, the, like, some tribe in the Middle East is like moving against like some militia group or whatever, and he's just like glazed over, doesn't give a shit. He's like, virus? What virus? There's a disease out there?
Right.
Like, wait, what? Like, right. He's a huge germaphobe. He's freaked out by this shit. It's so obvious that he was gonna be freaked out by coronavirus.
This, the idea that this guy didn't know all the pertinent information, especially by February, or the idea that you didn't understand that he was just basically talking shit when he comes out and says, oh, we'll be able to go to church by Easter. Like, is there anybody who really didn't think this at the time, that he was just talking out of his ass? But as you know, as Rob pointed out to us in our little production meeting, is that, you know, it does matter what this dude says. Like, that bully pulpit of the presidency is a thing, and it does matter. It matters when the president speaks and what he says. So yes, it does matter in that sense, but like, I can't imagine that anybody hears this tape and is genuinely surprised that Donald Trump would do this, that Donald Trump would act in only his self-interest and nobody else. Like, that he would behave this way. And of course, this comes on the heels as we switch gears with another ridiculous Trump story. Jeffrey Goldberg of The Atlantic put out a piece about President Trump essentially, you know, he's at Arlington Cemetery. He's visiting the graves.
It's kind of funny.
He's visiting the graves of dead American soldiers. And he's with the father of one of these dead soldiers. Everybody knows the worst thing that can happen to a parent is the loss of a child. And President Trump essentially says, I don't get it. What was in it for them? Essentially implying that being a volunteer soldier in the United States Army is a fool's errand. It's for suckers. Why the hell would anybody be stupid enough to do that? And he's saying that right next to the parent of a dead soldier.
Yeah, I mean, John Kelly, who ended up being his chief of staff after he said this comment, reportedly.
All John Kelly did, by the way, was, yes, continue to work for Trump, continue to ascend within the administration. Yeah.
And be silent now. Like, he doesn't, you know, he didn't even go on the record for this story. After, it's just, it's crazy. Like, that's a level of cuckery.
Gutlessness
that
is craziness.
It's crazy. But, yeah, I mean, the reality is that Trump, you know, in his like 2-year-old brain, ham-fisted way, kind of comes up on something in which he's like, why would anyone volunteer for the army? Right? Like, why would anyone volunteer for the army? And the reality is that people volunteer for the army for the most part these days out of a sense of, economic incentive, really. Like, sure. it's a way out of poverty for, yep, or like at least a perceived way out of poverty.
Yep.
Because tons of veterans come back, you know, and, you know, there's suicide rates and homelessness and all that stuff that comes with it. But, you know, that people are the underclass of this country, like the poor and working class people in this country are so beaten down. They have so little prospect and hope for any meaningful kind of path out of poverty that the army starts to look pretty good. And that's part of the trade-off in a way. It's like, you know, ever since America went to a full volunteer army sometime in the early 70s, before that it wasn't. That was one of the worries. But like, as kind of people's incomes went declining and the welfare state was gutted, all of a sudden the army starts to look pretty good. So yeah. Trump was kind of like putting his finger on something there.
Yes.
You know, for John Kelly specifically, his son probably went because of, like, you know, insane daddy issues or something, because John Kelly, you know, they didn't grow up poor. But, you know, he was probably like trying to impress his dad. But but again, the discourse around this whole story is like really mind numbing, right? Because Jeffrey Goldberg, who's now the editor at Atlantic, is like someone who should never have worked in journalism again after he published in 2002, in March of 2002, that Saddam Hussein had links to Al-Qaeda and basically was involved in 9/11, which is 100% false, 100% yes, debunked. This was in the New Yorker, which is the most prestigious liberal magazine in America with the most rigorous fact checking, supposedly. Jeffrey Goldberg published an article linking Saddam Hussein to Al-Qaeda, which is one of the key rationale for the war in Iraq. Yep. And Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11. Right. And again, it's just at the end of the day, it's just a gossip story. It's unlike the Woodward scoop, which is legitimate, like policy, had like legitimate policy ramifications. This is just like kind of Trump is just like a disgusting man story, not really kind of any actual. There's no real import to those comments beyond like, oh, he disrespected the troops or something. You know, it's yep, vague. It's not, it doesn't have like a real concrete policy thing. So, yeah, I mean, it all gets kind of fed through the meat grinder of the culture war. And people kind of sort themselves out in the two camps, like either like the libs are all now like, we should rename all the bases after John McCain because those were the real Republicans. Like Pete Buttigieg went on Fox News. It's like, you have to ask yourself, are you a John McCain Republican or Donald
no,
Trump Republican?
No, they hated John McCain. What are
they
you talking about?
They fucking hate John McCain.
Hated him.
Yeah, only they liberals love John him. McCain.
The Republicans hated John McCain, dude. That's why he couldn't beat W for the nomination. That's why he went to the freaking dark side when he, you know, he did the Palin stuff and all of that against Barack. because they hated him. Of course not. Did none of them? They were never John McCain Republicans.
Nah.
What do you? That's
they
never,
were always Trump Republicans.
Exactly. That like that was never the case. Like, and that's obvious. It's obvious. It's obvious because John McCain kept getting his ass kicked.
Yeah.
Until he started basically kowtowing to those same freaking Republicans. Like, basically what Republicanism stands for.
There,
for
there
real.
Was no popular base for John McCain.
Never. Or Mitt Romney. Never. No. Never. The guy had to freaking run against his own policies as a Republican. Like, these people were, like, they never loved Jeb Bush types. No.
It's the flip side of what we say about Biden. You know, Biden is essentially like kind of like, what are the differences between Joe Biden and John McCain? Nothing.
Nothing.
You know?
Nothing.
Literally nothing.
Nothing.
They probably agree on 99% of the issues.
Yeah.
But there's no popular mandate for those for like those type of people. Like, no one's excited to vote for Joe Biden for the same reason that no Republican was excited to vote for John McCain, outside of like, you know, defense contractors around you know, Chevy Chase in Virginia, who like love John McCain for like vague kind of patriotism reasons. But like,
and guess what? And I'm glad you brought up the culture war, because it's this stupid weird things that liberals are forced to do, and I don't know why. Like, why do we have to be military lovers now? We gotta suck the dick of the military just because Trump did something unbecoming? Like, we can hold two thoughts at the same time.
Defend the U.S. intervention in World War One, which was a mistake.
Yeah, 100%.
You know, Eugene Debs, the leader of the Socialist Party, went to prison for opposing the war. Woodrow Wilson put him in jail because the Socialist Party at the time opposed the war. And Woodrow Wilson put the leader of the Socialist Party in jail for it. He still ran for president and still got millions of votes. But it was a mistake. It was a mistake. It was known at the time that this was a pointless, stupid imperialist war between aristocracies, and the regular people had nothing to do with it, nothing worth fighting for. Millions of people were sent to their slaughter for literally no reason, you know? And like
people to this day still can't even tell you what World War One is about. Like, if somebody tries to explain it to you,
they murdered some dude in Serbia and some duke, and then all
the Russians and the Germans were like, hold on, we're involved now. And it's like, what?
Yeah. And then 15 million people are died like in the trenches in the meat grinder of the machine gun. But like, yeah. And it's something that something that bothered me so much about that Wonder Woman movie that everyone loved with Gal Gadot, which is a terrible movie. But the whole thing was this World War One thing where like the Germans were like these evil people. They were basically made them look like Nazis. And it's like, it just wasn't true.
Right.
You know, the Germans were like no worse or better than the French or the British or the Americans
Russians
in that war.
Americans,
it was just basically,
right.
It was all the same shit. You know, World War II was a legit like Titanic struggle between like good and evil, blah, blah, blah. But World War One was not. So like Trump saying, like asking like, why did we get into World War One? Who were the good guys in that war? And the Liberals like, oh my God,
America was the good guys.
America was the good guy. Like the Allies were the good guys. It's like, no, not really.
Not really. There were no good guys in that whole enterprise. It was just millions of people. And by the way, the beginning of modern warfare, even the people that ended up surviving that shit, like, this is the beginning of PTSD and all of that stuff. But whatever, you know, liberals gonna lib. They're gonna be rock-headed about the stupidest things. Of course, it's important that we have a president who is just so mindless and gutless that he can't even help himself in just the most, you know, just the basic, just basic human decency. Like, his carnal nature of just like, what's in it for me? Like, he can't even restrain that even for a second. Obviously, that speaks to the man. Obviously, he can't be a civil servant, man. Like, that dude can't serve anybody but himself.
Yeah.
And so, whatever. We move on from Trump is bad news to everybody's favorite Democratic presidential nominee, Joe Biden. Of course, Politico puts out a story, and I love the headline, Nando. Purity tests. Democrats clash over Biden's diversity goals, and the gist of the story is that the black bourgeoisie of the Democratic Party are essentially telling Joe Biden, hey, man, don't go crazy listening to those sicko leftists within the party. We get that they're loud and unhinged and deranged. And of course, we know that Bernie Sanders, who represents that element of the party, obviously has a lot of fans and supporters, and you want to appease those people because you want to win in November. But shit, man, there's a lot of black people that worked at prominent financial institutions, worked at hedge funds, worked on Wall Street, that can get some of these cabinet positions. Don't go crazy using that as some marker. And Nando, the official defense of this is that some black people had to take these jobs because they're high paying and they had to feed their family. So it can't be a demerit. Like, I'm sorry. You're financially secure now. You don't need... So, like, definitionally, that means you don't need these government jobs. Like, you've made a shit ton of money in the financial sector. Like, just definitionally, we know you don't need this freaking job. And so just the idea that, oh, it shouldn't be used as a demerit because I don't come from a family with money, so I had to go out. That's cool. You made money. You work in those institutions. That doesn't mean that somebody who is appointed by the people of this country should have folks like you appointed to run important things that affect their lives. Yeah. Just so more cronyism can happen. Just because black people get into those positions doesn't mean that it won't be crony capitalism again. Like, I don't want, like, the argument is just an incoherent one. And also, it's like this idea that you just can't find qualified black people who don't come from those institutions. And those, like, and we talk about, it's important why we talk about these institutions, right? Like, working on K Street, working at Goldman Sachs, going to Harvard and Yale and Princeton, all of those institutions, those are all little clubs within themselves. And the Dems love those fucking clubs. They just do, bruh. And so, like, this idea is like, hold on, man, we're not going to turn off the spigot now. We got black people in those clubs. We, like, it's like, this is the Dems' idea of diversity and inclusion. It's don't address the conditions that produce these outcomes, which is don't address the fact that Wall Street has been, y'all been taking cues from Wall Street and the financial services industries for decades. And the current climate and culture of our country is what these are the outcomes that produced. Like, we did this already. This is what you guys have produced for us. Why would we keep doing the same thing? So you're just telling me putting black faces on that same process is going to make the lives of black people in the hood better? Like, how could that possibly be the argument?
Well, that's why the left criticizes identity politics. I mean, this is one of the most crystal clear examples of the limits of identity politics and representation for representation's sake.
Yes.
You know, if you don't do anything to change the power structures, representation is essentially meaningless. You know, I mean, the classic example is that we had a black president, Barack Obama, and in his time as president, black wealth like collapsed. You know, it did nothing to help actual black people. You know, like, it doesn't mean that, like, his example and stuff isn't, like, inspirational on some symbolic level, but in material terms, black wealth collapsed under the Obama presidency. And this is just how that kind of well-meaning push for diversity can get twisted for cynical aims to basically reinforce the power structure, which is, like, you know, the old joke is like, yeah, the future is a drone panel in which, like, there's like a trans person and a gay person and a black person and an Asian person, and they're talking about drone warfare, and it's like sponsored by Raytheon, you know. It doesn't matter, like, that those people are diverse. The problem is drone bombing, you know. So this is just like the latest example in how the Democratic Party specifically has understood identity politics as a very, very effective weapon against the left, right? Against any meaningful transformation of the economic structures in America. They use things like Bernie running against Hillary Clinton is sexist, you know? And it's like, you know, and then Hillary Clinton says that, like, well, breaking up the banks solve racism. No, you know, like, it's like what does that even mean? You know, the breaking up the banks would do a lot to help people's lives, you know, but then racism, I don't know. Like, you know, like, I mean, maybe like some white guy will still call you the N-word, Waz, but like, sure, you know, if sure. you're, if you, you know, like if the predations of Wall Street are not like ruining your life, I think you could probably live with that.
You could probably live with it. The trade-off there is quite easy to understand.
Right. Yeah. So this is just what that is. I mean, this is just like this is just such a crystal clear example of it. And the woman who's been pushing this is a woman by the name of Nicole Venable. Okay. And Nicole Venable, she's black. She is a lobbyist. Like, she is a straight up K Street lobbyist for things like FedEx, CVS Health, Navient Corp, which is like a student loan, like predatory lender, you know, like all manner of just off. Industries, but she's understood. Like, she got a seat at the table, you know, as mm-hmm. as a member of the black bourgeoisie, mm-hmm. as you called it, you know. And what they try to do is kind of put like this progressive sheen on the status quo. It's like, look, you know, we have the black CEO of this like because awful company.
But the problem is, though, Nando, like, it does make a certain type of black person feel better to see it. Like, I know it just from my experience in life,
yeah,
right?
I'm like, sure.
When you are a black yuppie as I am, and you tend to only hang around black yuppies, like, I'm telling you, they do yes Queen Kamala Harris's VP nomination. Like, they're like, this is great. This is another upwardly mobile black person being upwardly mobile, right? Like, it does warm the heart of a certain type of black person, but it's a minority of black people. It just straight up is.
Yeah.
And, you know, like,
but they're the ones with cultural influence.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, I just don't understand how having a black treasury secretary who worked at Goldman Sachs is going to make a difference. All I see when I see black Democrats talk about, hey, man, these purity tests are going to fuck up diversity. All I see is them saying, we have people who we already like, who happen to be black. Let's throw them in, right? Yeah. And I want to, you know, there's a quote in the political story from Jeff Hauser of the Revolving Door Project, right? And he says, quote, to say that we would have to have people who are currently working in private equity or Wall Street or the banking industry to take up senior economic jobs is absurd. You can come up with a few very rich set of potential appointees of color without taking on people who are currently and very recently closely identified with high finance. Like, this is not rocket science, y'all. This is not rocket science. Like, you cannot get the people from those same institutions to come in and do things that are contrary to the goals of those institutions, which is just complete and utter avarice. That's it.
Yeah.
It's just about making as much money as you possibly can. They have no freaking principles, goals. They're not invested in what happens to communities of color as far as poor people.
They can say the words. They can say the words that, like, assuage white liberal guilt on those fronts, you know, like, what was that hilarious policy that Kamala was promoting, like Pell grants for God, like you know, loan people who started businesses, Pell grant relief for like
it's like you have to do it within the next 3 years. It was just like, what?
Maybe the black secretary of treasury could come up with the next policy like that,
like, you know? Like, oh, if you open a juice bar in Compton, it's just like, what the hell are you even talking about, bro? And how many people, like, this neoliberal version of diversity and inclusion, it's like we always say, and again, it's not to beat a dead horse, but it's to just show you examples of this stuff in practice, right? It's like, no, make sure you get some fancy Negroes in there, period.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Period. Because the type of Negro who gets in there matters to them. And it matters to us, too.
Yeah.
And it matters to us that it's not a fancy. Like, for us, we don't want fancy Negroes. No. We don't want bourgeoisie Negroes. They're a part of the power structure. We don't want that. We want the Jamal Bowman types. Like, we want people who actually have some type of connection. You know, Corey Bush, like some type of connection to normal, everyday people.
Yeah, the guy who went to Harvard, like, is indistinguishable from, like, you know, Walter Price, you know, whatever, like blonde hair, khaki wearing.
Straight up
and down. Harvard douchebag. Yeah.
And sorry, you know, the further we get away from the campaign and the presidency, yes, Barry is one of those Harvard douchebags, y'all. and anyway, you know, something else that came up. What was that? Oh, Washington Post put out a story about essentially, you know, a progressive panel was made in conjunction with the Biden campaign to come up with some policy planks. Essentially, the banking community said that they talked to Joe Biden and all of those things were just suggestions and he's going to throw it out the window. Washington Post.
As soon as he gets in there.
Yeah, as soon as he gets in there. The Washington Post described it as Biden having, quote, flexibility on policy. Yeah. Nando, what do you think about that euphemism there? Flexibility. That's
amazing. Yeah, he's flexible. he's flexible. He it only bends in one direction. Flexible all the way to the right.
Exactly.
I mean, this was – so when Bernie Sanders lost to Joe Biden in the primary, the basic concession that he got for essentially playing ball – and supporting Joe Biden and campaigning for him and all that stuff is these unity task forces in which they were going to like bring members of the Bernie campaign and members of the Biden campaign. And they were going to come up with policy proposals together. And of course, like, you know, Bernie's campaign did their best to like include things like whatever, you know, like meaningful climate legislation, something to rein in Wall Street and blah, blah, blah. And obviously there's there's nothing binding Joe Biden to any of these policies. He can walk away from them whenever he wants, you know, but that's what, in theory, Bernie got as a concession. And even that small symbolic concession was a bridge too far for
the money class.
Yeah, the money class, essentially. And they've been calling the Biden campaign. They're like, are you guys fucking serious about this shit? Like, you guys are really going to consider doing any shit? And they're like, no, we're not. We're not at all. Not at all. This is just some bullshit that we do to like keep those fucking crazies on the left, you know, appeased. But like, we don't plan on doing any of this shit. Don't worry. It's going to be fine. You know, it's depressing. I mean, I suspect Bernie's no fool, you know, because Bernie's been around the block and he knows how power works. And I don't think he was naive to think that any of this would have the meaningful kind of policy effect that he would like. But I mean, I think Bernie's caught like in an impossible position. It's like, well, what is he going to do? Not campaign for Joe Biden and like let Donald Trump win re-election. I understand Bernie's impulse to like do whatever he can to get Trump out, like as a first step. And then, you know, and then see what you can do after that. But like the conditions I think have shown under Trump that it's difficult for the left to meaningfully have the conversations that it wants to have about the economy when Trump is saying things like, you know, Hitler, not such a bad guy. Maybe he had a point when he did all the bad things, you know, like, and then everyone has to like talk about that for a week. You know what I mean? Instead of like talking about, there's something like the $1 trillion CARES Act in which we just gave corporations and the investor class trillions of dollars while we left everyone else out to dry. So I think that's Bernie's calculus, but yeah, this just shows like everyone who, you know, all these kind of like people on the left that were like, look, we got all these like policies in the task force thing. It's like, that was just naivete. Like they're not going to do any of that shit unless they're forced to in some meaningful way. And because of our stupid two-party system, like what are we going to do? Like tank a Biden presidency to allow Trump to win re-election? It's an impossible choice, right? It's an impossible choice. So, you know, Bernie's made the calculation that I think most people on the left have done this. Like you just got to get Trump out and then live to fight another day and figure it out from there. But yeah.
All right. Well, and finally this week, my dreams and hopes of a Lionel Messi and Man in the baby City, blue. Yes, in the blue of Manchester City have been dashed at least temporarily. Essentially, Barcelona dug in their heels. They said that, you know, you had a date to do this. You missed your deadline. If you want to go, Man City's going to have to essentially give us $750 million with a B, y'all, dollars for your services. And so I think the can has been kicked down the road. Messi essentially said he's coming back because he has to. He wasn't going to take Barcelona to court. He doesn't have that level of ill feelings towards them. Basically, the head CEO of the team remains in place. But it seems like they're just – it seems like if you read the tea leaves, when you saw the – you saw the interview that he gave. Messi notoriously does not talk.
No, he doesn't.
He notoriously does not talk. And he basically did the Messi version of unloading on Barcelona. Yeah. And basically, he's coming back under duress. He's going to finish out the play out the season. Nando, please give the people, you know, some additional analysis of Lionel Messi staying
one
with
thing that's confusing about all this
Barcelona.
To the average American sports fan is that Barcelona, like Real Madrid and like two other clubs in Spain, are actually run democratically. You know, the fans vote for the president of the club.
Wow.
Yeah. Like, imagine you got to vote, Blas, for the GM of the Knicks, you know?
Oh, my goodness. For the owner of the fucking Mets?
Yeah, you got to vote out John Dolan and
Jesus Christ.
Or whatever his name is.
And the Wilpons.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but that's how it works in Barcelona. This guy has one more year left on his term. So he's happy, you know, like the president of Barcelona is happy. He's like, I'm not going to be the guy who let Messi go.
Messi, right.
So he lives to fight another day. I mean, basically what he had to do is hold out strong, just kind of be quiet and let the lawyers kind of look at the contract. And I think, Messi has negotiated a clause in his contract that allows him to leave at the end of the season, but he has a very brief window to exercise it, you know? And in this case, because there was some confusion because of the pandemic extended the season, but it didn't extend the sort of contract dates, you know, that were originally stipulated, and Messi missed his window to exercise the I get out of jail free card. He tried to argue that maybe because the end of the season was pushed back, that the contract clause will automatically be pushed back. And Barcelona was like, no way. And I'm guessing Messi's lawyers looked at it and they're like, well, we could fight this in court. We could hash it out in court but it doesn't look great, you know? Messi, you know, Barca's not going to sell him. That was one thing people were like, oh, well, maybe Barca just takes 100 million euros for him.
That's what I was thinking too. This was a negotiation tactic of, the 775 million was the initial offer.
That's his release clause, which is in soccer, in Spain, actually, just in Spain, all players have something called a release clause. There's a fee attached to them that if someone pays it, they can walk. No negotiation. That's how Neymar left Barcelona. Barca did not want to sell Neymar, but they didn't have a choice. PSG paid the clause, Neymar agreed to it, and that's it. Barca can't do anything about it. Right. So Messi's release clause is 700 million euros or whatever, something insane. No Barcelona president was ever going to negotiate for the sale of Messi. They'd rather go down, you know what I mean? They'll go to
just
the
let him walk, and then it will be he left of his own volition. Right. We had no hands.
Yeah, we can't do anything about
leaving
it.
The team.
Yeah.
Right,
exactly.
Right, got you.
But anyone who collaborates with the sale of Messi would have riots on the streets in front of their house forever.
They'll always be known as
that guy who sold Messi. I don't know.
Got you.
It was never going to happen in that way. I mean, I thought that Messi was going to. I thought Messi was going to take this issue of the release of the contract release a little bit further. But yeah, like you said, that interview was crazy. He's playing under duress. It feels like he's just going to be there for the year, and then as soon as he can exercise the clause to get out of his contract at the end of the season. Although you never know, things can change in a year. You know, it's very conceivable that Barca turns it around next season and wins the league, for example. Right. And then in that case, maybe like, maybe I'll stay. You know what I mean? But yeah, Barca lives to fight another day with Messi. Waz does not get Messi at Man City. It's very sad.
And also it upsets me because I know for a fact, you know, the next go around, now that everybody knows that he's looking to do something, there are going to be more people involved in a potential Messi recruitment. Although we know there's only a few serious people. I'm sure PSG could probably put together a nice little offer for him.
Yeah.
Obviously, of course, we know Man City with that oil money. They're not going to fuck around. But I think, you know, there will just be more teams in the running the next go around, which distresses me as a City fan.
Yeah.
But, yeah, man, Barcelona, like Lando said, lives to fight another day. That's our show for today. Make sure you become a patron of Count the Dings. That's patreon.com/countthedings. Listen to Let's Pod It Out, Nando's outstanding Entourage Recap Pod. Make sure you subscribe to the Mailbag and Cinephobe and all the other offerings on countthedings.com. We'll see you guys next week. For Nando Vila, I'm Big Waz. We're out of here.